All right. Job 15:16 this evening is where we were. Job 15:16. Well, Job just got done talking in Job 14. So is Eliphaz, the termite, the Temanite. Eliphaz, Temanite, in his turn again. We've heard from Eliphaz before, but we're going to hear from him again. If you remember Eliphaz, he was the first to chime in back in chapter 4, and we haven't heard from him for a while, but we're going to hear from him again. And he's one of Job's three friends. You're starting to think, with friends like this, who needs enemies? But and that's exactly what Job is beginning to think of his friends, by the way, is that they are his enemies. But meanwhile, so Eliphaz decides he's going to chime in and begin another attack upon the character of Job. And that's exactly what he does. Then answered Eliphaz the Temanite and said, that of course, Job 15, verse 1, should a wise man utter vain knowledge? So what he is saying is that what Job is saying is vain. And, of course, Mike knows the definition of something vain. To no purpose. Exactly right. That's the biblical definition, something which is to no purpose. So having vain knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind, should he reason with unprofitable talk? Of course, there would be, of course, the definition too, something that's unprofitable, to no purpose. Should he reason with something that is unprofitable, to no purpose, without any kind of a sense to it, or with speeches wherewith he can do no good? So what Eliphaz is saying to Job is that everything that he has said to this point is in fact all vanity, all there is no reason in what he is saying. Job's argument to this point is this, is that man standing before God is unrighteous in and of himself. And the only thing that, the only real hope that God, that man has, although Job hasn't phrased it this way, is the grace of God. And we've seen Job hope for a mediator between man and God. And of course, we do have a mediator, Christ Jesus. But that was an unknown to Job at that time. You know, we understand that. The character of Job, of course, has been assassinated and is called into question again. And now Job is accused of not fearing God. We're told by the Apostle Paul to fear God. You know, even though Romans 5:1 says that we're at peace with God, is it wise to have a healthy fear of God, even in this Ephesians 3:2 dispensation of the grace of God? Absolutely. Absolutely. To not fear God is very unhealthy. To not, you know, the fear of God is a respect of God, is to realize that God is the creator of the universe, is all-powerful, all-knowledgeable, all-holy, all-righteous, and that we're not. To realize that we're not God. You know, as I often like to say, He's God and we're not. That's, you know, a healthy respect and fear of God, knowing our place in the universe, knowing our place in the pecking order of things in chicken talk. Now that the chicken coop is done, I can talk chicken. But meanwhile, Job is accused of not fearing God, that he is placing himself somewhere that he should not, and not praying to God, not asking God for redemption, not asking God for forgiveness. And Eliphaz says, "Yea, thou castest off fear and restraineth prayer before God." In other words, you're not fearing God, you're not praying. And of course, that does raise the question, who would, if you know you're guilty before God, Job professes to fear God, he professes that there is a God, and if you were such that thought that there was a God, that one who was powerful, one who brought down condemnation on the unrighteous or on the wicked, if you thought yourself guilty of being wicked, unrighteous, of being wrong, would you, in fact, pray as if you were not those things? Would you talk to God as if you were not guilty? Yeah, that would be the question, I suppose. Would you lie to God knowing that He knew you were lying? Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I don't think that anybody in their right mind, knowing God is all knowing, would in their right mind do that. But here, that's the accusation that's being made. Look at verse 5 and 6. Eliphaz says, "For thy mouth uttereth thine iniquity." In other words, you're lying to God in what you're saying. And thou choosest the tongue of the crafty. Thy own mouth condemneth thee, and not I. Yea, thine own lips testify against thee. What you're saying is condemning yourself. Your story condemns yourself. And that's, so basically he's not only at this point, to this point, his friends have said your condition is testimony against the fact that your righteousness is not true, but now you're lying to us. And so he's being called a liar. And they're telling him that he's lying to God and lying to himself about his praying and how he thinks about God and how he feels about God and fearing God and all these things. So these are quite deep condemnations, really. If you've ever had somebody question your salvation or question, you know what you believe, and yet if someone questions what you say you believe, that's exactly what is going on here. So, what happens next is Eliphaz compares Job to Adam being the first man. And there was a time, of course, and I'm sure you realize, that before sin entered into the world, where God and man communed together. And there was a state of perfection in the world. And, Adam was in a state of sinlessness prior to sin entering. And so Eliphaz really mocks Job and says, "Do you presume yourself to be in a state of sinlessness such as Adam was, the first man?" That's not what Job is saying, obviously. None of us presume ourselves to be sinless or to be perfect. But that's what the inference here is. And so in verse 7, Eliphaz tells Job, "Art thou the first man that was born? Or wast thou made before the hills? Hast thou heard the secret of God, and dost thou restrain wisdom to thyself?" Do you know things that we don't? Are you perfect? Are you sinless? Are you all these things? "What knowest thou that we know not? What understandest thou which is not in us? With us are both the gray-headed and very aged men, much elder than thy father." In other words, we've got more experienced men to draw on than you do. And yet we don't know the things that you seem to profess to know. So how be it that a younger man without the resources that we have professes to know the things that you say you know and has the wisdom that you say you have? Kind of an interesting situation, isn't it? Yeah. And we always look at old people, or I say old people, elder people, those who are who are advanced in their years, assuming that they have more advanced knowledge, do we not? Because of experience.
Been around longer.
Been around longer, yeah. The longer you're around, the more experience you have, the more time to accumulate knowledge, and so on and so forth it goes. The younger you are, the less time you've accumulated knowledge, you're still green, and on it goes. So it would, you know, as night falls the day, it just would make sense that the older would be wiser, smarter, more experienced than the younger. And so if you want to find wisdom and knowledge and all that, where do you turn? Turn to the older. And that's the argument being made here. We, you know, Eliphaz is saying, we have the older people to turn to draw from. You know, our experience is on our side. Experience is on our side. Who are you to be telling us what to believe? Who are you to be telling us what to think? Who are you to be telling us all this strange doctrine? These strange ideas. Because, frankly, who are you? Yeah. It's no different than turn on the TV and hear some young guy, you know, on the preaching channel, and hear some young guy. Well, he sounds good, seems to make sense, but he's young. And then you flip the channel to preaching point two, and here's an old guy. And, well, it's a different message, but he's old. He's more experienced. He's been around for, he's been preaching for 83 years. He must be right because he's been preaching for 83 years. The messages are different. Who are you going to believe? Well, the old guy, because he's been around for, you know, since dirt was invented. The young guy can't be right. There's just no doubt about that. And that's what Eliphaz is saying. Well, frankly, you need to check the book when it comes to preaching. Well, I just, you know. So, what you see is the revelation of the thinking of Job's friends. That justification before God can be earned with works. And that is so common amongst people who profess to be Christians. That's the thinking of most of the world today. Most of the world's religions are based upon that, is justification by works and not by faith alone. See, they question Job's doctrine. And when you peel away the onion the skin of the onion of what Job is saying, what you find at the heart of what Job is saying is a doctrine of faith without works. What Job is getting down to is, I can't do anything to justify myself. I can't do anything to increase my holiness, to increase my righteousness. So in verse 11, Eliphaz says, are the consolations of God small with thee? Are the things that you get from God, you know, are they inconsequential? Is there any secret thing with thee? What doth thine heart carry thee away? Or why doth thy heart carry thee away? And what do thy eyes wink at? That thou turnest thy spirit against God and let such words go out of thy mouth. In other words, Job has been arguing that his righteousness is before God, as it is. His friends have been arguing that he needs to do something Job's saying, no, there's nothing I can do. His friends say, yes, you have to do something. Job says, no, there's nothing I can do. And so they say, well, what is it that has turned your spirit against God? Why aren't you doing something for God to get Him to turn, to try to assuage God, in other words, to make God happy with you? That's what their argument is to try to make God happy. And that's what people try to do today, isn't it? They think when things are going bad that God is mad at them, and you have to do something to make God happy with them. Yeah. So Eliphaz says, what is man that he should be clean? And he which is born of a woman that he should be righteous? Behold, he putteth no trust in it. And so what he's doing, he is quoting what Job had said earlier. These are the words that Job had used earlier, if you recall. And this is, let us such words go out of thy mouth. I can't believe you have said these words. And so this is it. What is man that he should be clean? What this is going on is Eliphaz believes that a man can be clean. If you do enough righteous things, good things, you can be clean. You can be righteous and pure and holy before God. What is that? If we could do that today, what would that eliminate the need for? The cross. Yeah. The cross. There'd be no need for a Savior, no need for a cross, no need for the blood. There'd be no need for any of that mess. Well, there'd be no need for grace. There'd be no need for grace or for mercy. What you'd have is a God who looked down and judged you according to what you did. And if what you did wasn't good enough, then you needed to do better. He would throw things at you and beat you up until you did good enough. And you would know that you weren't doing good enough because He was beating you up all the time. And when He quit beating you up, then you knew that you would improve to the point where He was happy with you. And Eliphaz is saying, what are you talking about that you can't be clean? What are you talking about that you can't be holy? I can't believe those words would come out of your mouth. And he which is born of a woman, that he should be righteous. I can't believe that you're saying that a man can't be righteous. Behold, he putteth no trust in his saints. Yea, the heavens are not clean in his sight. Of course the heavens are clean in his sight. He made the heavens. The angels are holy. Because the angels, if they weren't holy, God would destroy the angels. He'd do the same thing to the angels that he does to you. He put boils on them too. How much more abominable and filthy is man which drinketh iniquity like water? Only the evil get that done to them. Not the clean is Eliphaz's doctrine. Then of course, of course, we know where that goes. I mean, we've talked about that before. We know where that goes. And the evils of where that goes and the thinking of where that goes, it's besides the fact that when you have a select event that happens, a natural disaster, for instance, or a car wreck, or just take any event that happens and you think, even if it just crosses your mind for a moment, God must have been punishing those people. Well, what about the innocent baby that was in there, in the car, or the church that got destroyed, which somebody hadn't been saved in that church? What about just lost the train of my thought. It'll come back to me. What I was going to say is that whole attitude of God selectively punishing people through natural causes or through car wrecks or whatever it might be. You know, people carry that on to racial divides. We have in Dayton, for instance, a racial divide. We have a Miami River that runs north and south. And on the east side of the Miami River, well, 90% of the people who live on the east side of the Miami River are white. On the west side of the Miami River, 90% of the people who live on that side are black. And you cross the bridge, and you can tell the difference, can you not? You can tell the difference. There's no doubt about it. Is it God that's doing that to the black people? Is it God that's keeping them down? I can find in the Bible where God cursed Ham. Was he the first black guy? You see how you can take those prejudices and those... And that's exactly what people do. That's what people do with that kind of doctrine. Eliphaz maintains that his doctrine, that the wicked are oppressed for life, is the correct doctrine. I'm telling you that kind of doctrine can be just carried to the nth degree. Not only the west side of Dayton, but continents like Africa. You know, why does a continent like Africa prosper? You know, why do people live in squalor? Why do countries like Ethiopia starve? And, you know, why is there squalor there? You know, well, because they're the wrong color, and God doesn't like them so very much. Well, here's Eliphaz in Job 15:17. I will show thee, hear me, and that which I have seen I will declare, which wise men have told from their fathers, and I have not hid it. In other words, he's going to declare the experience of people who have gone past it from generation to generation to generation. So none of it's new. None of it's new. And that's exactly what happens, is all the prejudices and all the doctrines of you know, hatred, and the doctrines of God hating the wicked, and whatever false doctrines people think are passed down from generation to generation, generally. Unto whom alone the earth was given, and no stranger passed among them, the wicked man travaileth with pain all his days, and the number of years is hidden to the oppressor. A dreadful sound is in his ears in prosperity. The destroyer shall come upon him. So what happens is the wicked will have dark days. Prosperity will elude them. Or if they do prosper, what happens is that prosperity will go away. It will always be taken from them. Verse 22 and 23 says, he believeth not that he shall return out of darkness, and he is waited for of the sword. He wandereth abroad for bread, saying, where is it? He knoweth that the day of darkness is ready at his hand. Their lives are lived in fear, wondering always what's going to happen next. You know, it's a wonderful thing knowing that no matter what happens next, you can look beyond the events of today or the events of tomorrow into eternity and have a hope, as the Apostle Paul says. There's always hope when you're saved. There's always a hope with the Christian. But for those who are evil, Eliphaz says there is never hope, and there's always fear of the day. Trouble and anguish shall make him afraid, and they shall prevail against him as a king ready to the battle. Of course, you and I know that, you know, some people are afraid of the day, but there's even hope for them because there's hope in Christ. Mike might knock on their door and give them the gospel, and they might believe and be saved. There's always hope. There's always hope. Of course, we know that for us, God, 2 Timothy 1:7, hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. And in those things, there is not constant fearing and constant wondering what's going to happen. But there is the problem with those who do not fear God. Psalm 36:1, Romans 3:18, there is no fear of God in them, is what those verses say, is that Job 15:25, stretcheth out his hand against God. They are enemies of God, the wicked are, and strengthen themselves against the Almighty. There are people in this world, unfortunately, who are just enemies of God. And they hate God. They're enemies of God. Yeah, Mike.
I just wanted to mention this. I do always do when you talk about wicked. And it's in 2 Thessalonians 3:2. And Paul's praying. And that we may be delivered from unreasonable and wicked men. And what makes them that? For all men have not faith.
Yeah.
Have the trouble with them. They're just not trusting what he did on the cross. And that's why they're wicked.
That's right. Yeah. 2 Thessalonians 3:2 is what Mike just brought up, that we might be delivered from unreasonable and wicked men. And the reason being is because for not all men have faith, and that's what makes them wicked. And, and that agrees with what Psalm 36:1, Romans 3:18 said. They don't have the fear of God. Yeah, they don't have faith. They don't have the fear of God. And they're at enmity with God, is what they are. And they stretch out their hand against God. They're at enmity with God. And they strengthen themselves against the Almighty, is what's going on. Does the Bible say that God retaliates against them because of that? No. But Eliphaz, Job's friends, in fact, have the outlook and the doctrine that says that God does take retaliation in this life against them. And even though there's going to be times where you see a wicked person and they prosper, they might do well, God is going to knock them off their throne. God's going to shoot that arrow at them, that lightning bolt, and get them while they're still living. That's Eliphaz's view. That's Job's friend's point of view, that they're always, always going to get theirs before they die. So you can, just like clockwork, you can tell who is evil and who is good. With this doctrine that Eliphaz and his friends present to Job, you can tell just like clockwork who is a friend of God and who is an enemy of God. Because an enemy of God is before they die at some point, God is going to zap them and knock them down. They're going to end up in the gutter, in the dust, and in squalor. Look and see what happens here in verse 26 through 29. He runneth upon him. So this is God taking care of the wicked. He runneth upon him, even on his neck, upon the thick bosses of his bucklers, because he covereth his face with fatness. In other words, the evil man, he's sitting with the fatness of the earth, and maketh collops of fat on his flanks. You can just see the collops of fat on his flanks. What's that called that that ladies do when they get pregnant? I can't remember what it's called. Collops of fat on their flanks. Somebody will tell me what that's called. But at any rate, they're overweight, is what it is. They're overweight. Because they have plenty to eat. And he dwells in desolate cities, and in houses which no man inhabiteth, which are ready to become heaps. He shall not be rich, neither shall his substance continue, neither shall he prolong the perfection thereof upon the earth. So, he might prosper. Collapse of obesity. Well, they're about the same thing there, Betty. They might prosper for a time, but God is going to get them before they die. It's not even going to be in the next, after they die. It's not going to be, this has nothing to do with going to hell. God is going to get them in this life. Look at the next few verses here. Verse 30, he shall not depart out of darkness. The flame shall dry up his branches, and by the breath of his mouth shall he go away. Let not him that is deceived trust in vanity, for vanity shall be his recompense. It shall be accomplished before his time. So it's not going to wait until he dies. Before his time of death, it's going to come to God's going to get him. And his branch shall not be green. He shall shake off his unripe grape as the vine, and shall cast off his flower as the olive. For the congregation of hypocrites shall be desolate, and fire shall consume the tabernacles of bribery. They conceive mischief and bring forth vanity, and their belly prepareth deceit. And that's exactly, by the way, where Eliphaz and his buddies say that Job is right now. So, calling him a hypocrite and vain, and all the things that he's saying, that his flowers have been cast off his olive branches, and just in a bad situation. Well, Job's been accused of speaking vanity, things that have come to no reason. Now he accuses his friends of saying the same thing, of doing the same thing, for to no purpose. That everything that Eliphaz and his friends are saying have no purpose at all. It's funny when you're having an argument with someone, and an argument can be constructive, or it can be very vain. An argument can have no purpose, can it, Mike? You've been married a couple times. I'm sure you've had some vain arguments in your life, ones that had no purpose, and I have too. Matter of fact, most of the arguments that I've had with Beth have had no purpose to them in the end, because they. Well, I'm sure Beth thinks they had a purpose. But, when you really analyze them, there really wasn't a purpose. Yeah, there really was not a purpose. They didn't solve anything. They just were there for argument's sake. Exactly right. Yeah. A good argument actually solves a problem and actually constructs an answer. That's right. But what's going on here is just arguing for arguing's sake. It's not solving any problem. And So here, Job's friends are saying that what Job is saying is vain. In other words, has no purpose to it. And so what Job is going to tell them is, what you're saying is, has no purpose to it either. So basically, nobody's saying anything that has any purpose. So basically, you take the book of Job and just rip it right out of your Bible, has no purpose. So at any rate, Job 16, verse 1. Then Job answered and said, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are y'all. Yeah. As it turns out, Job is from the same part of Kentucky that Paul was. He says, y'all are bad comforters. Shall vain words have an end, or what emboldeneth thee that thou answerest? Y'all are terrible friends, and you haven't said anything that makes any sense. Job says, I would accuse you, but I'm a better man than you are. That's what it really boils down to. I'm a better man than you are. And if I did accuse you, I wouldn't say the things that you said, because frankly, what would it accomplish? What would it accomplish? Job's saying, I'm the one who's pointing out that this whole argument doesn't have any meaning to it whatsoever. And so I'm not going to engage in your level of accusation. And you see that in verses 4 and 5. He says, I could also speak as ye do. If your soul were in my soul's stead, I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you. But I would strengthen you with my mouth. This is what I would do. I would strengthen you with my mouth. And the moving of my lips should assuage your grief. Much better idea. So while Job's friends are engaged in tearing him down and trying to point out what they think are his faults, his imagined faults in their minds. Because if you remember, now let me just take you back a little bit. Job was the richest man in the world. And oh, how fun it is to see those who are up here fall. And now, oh, how fun it is to engage in character assassination, especially when someone's down. And that's exactly what they're doing. It's easy to stomp on someone when they're at their lowest point. And that's exactly what they're doing. And Job refuses to engage in the same thing. He says, I can do that to you, but I'm not going to. If you were in the same situation, I would try to assuage your grief, not assassinate your character. And we need to remember that response. No matter who it is. Paul says in Galatians 6:2, to bear you one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. We're to bear each other's burdens, each other's problems, to help one another when another has a problem, no matter what it is. Not to assassinate the character of the other and to point out character flaws, because we all have them. But rather to bear that burden and to help the other person through that problem, rather than to point out why you're in that problem and why you're such a horrible person and why God hates you and why you're going to hell because you're in the situation you are and why on and on and on and on and on. And because I've seen that happen in churches before. How much better it is to try to assuage the grief and hold hands and cry for a while with the person who needs to have some hand-holding. So Job looks at his friends, and I use that term very, very lightly, but he looks at his friends and he sees that he is really compassed about by enemies. He's surrounded by enemies, and he looks at them and sees that they are sent from God. That they're sent from God. And it says in verses 6 through 11, though I speak, my grief is not assuaged. And though I forbear, what am I eased? You know, oftentimes talking about something is a good way to get it off your chest and a good way to work it out, a good way to ease your pain. But Job says, I've talked about this and I don't feel any better. He says, but now he hath made me weary. Thou hast made desolate all my company. You guys are the worst company I've ever had. You guys are the worst burden bearers I've ever experienced. You guys have just made me feel worse for being here. And thou, verse 8, hast filled me with wrinkles, which is a witness against me, and my leanness rising up in me beareth witness to my face. In other words, I look worse now than I did when you showed up. He teareth me in his wrath, who hateth me. He gnasheth upon me with his teeth. My enemy sharpeneth his eyes upon me. They have gaped upon me with their mouth. They have smitten me upon the cheek reproachfully and have gathered themselves together against me. God hath delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over into the hands of the wicked. And who he's talking about there is his friends. Is his friends. That those people, the three friends that are gathered around him, those are the ones that have gaped upon him with their mouths. They have smitten him upon the cheek reproachfully. They have gathered themselves against him, and God has delivered Job to them, the ungodly. And they are the ones that are the wicked. They are the ones that are the wicked. So Job's life of ease that he had when we started has been broken to pieces. He says, I was at ease, but he hath broken me asunder. He hath also taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces and set me up for his mark. His archers compass me round about. He cleaveth my reins asunder and doth not spare. He poureth out my gall upon the ground. He breaketh me with breach upon breach. He runneth upon me like a giant. Well, Job's response is mourning for his condition. Now, some would think that that's feeling sorry for yourself, but Matthew 5:4, the Lord said, blessed are those that mourn, for they will be comforted. That's right. They will be comforted. So his is the proper response. His is the proper response. He says, I've sewed sackcloth upon my skin and defiled my horn in the dust. My face is foul with weeping, and on my eyelids is the shadow of death. He's mourning for what's going on. He's mourning for what's going on. Remember, last time we read in Job that Job made the decision that he would be a hypocrite if he changed his behavior, if he that he was not doing anything that warranted what was going on, the trials in his life that were being given to him. He was not doing anything that deserved all this adversity that was being given to him. So he was not going to change his behavior. He was not going to try to become super saint or pray, you know, 48 times a day or you know, whatever you can dream up. He was not going to do that. He was going to maintain his life the same as it had been before, other than the fact that he was going to mourn. He was in sackcloth and ashes. And he maintained that his trials, again, he maintains that his trials are not the result of any iniquity in his life. Verse 17, Job says, "Not for any injustice in mine hands. Also, my prayer is pure." Remember, he was accused of not only wickedness, but of not praying. He says, "My prayer is pure, my life is pure." And he's, his longing is that his testimony, his true testimony could be heard, because he knows the record of his righteousness is before God in heaven. But he's being accused here on earth. You know, if you've ever been accused, you know that your testimony lies somewhere. The truth lies, somebody knows the truth somewhere. And you wish that truth, I mean, even if it's just God, you wish that God would speak up and tell the truth to everybody so that everybody would know. And that's what Job wishes for. He says, "Also now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and my record is on high. My friends scorn me, but mine eye poureth out tears unto God. I wish that God would be my witness in this. I wish God would be my lawyer." Well, again, 1 Timothy 2:5. What Job needs is a mediator. He needs a lawyer. He needs a witness. None of us are innocent before God, but Job doesn't deserve what he's getting, and he's certainly not as guilty as what his friends are describing. And so he says in verse 21 and 22, "Oh, that one might plead for a man with God, as a man pleadeth for his neighbor." Of course, what he's describing is a mediator, the man Christ Jesus. "When a few years are come, and I shall go the way whence I shall not return." So what Job needs and is describing is a mediator that would stand between him and God, of course, at the time of his death, and plead his innocence, just as the way that Christ pleads ours for us now.